You can get 3 months of The Spectator for just £15, plus a free bottle of Paul Roger champagne if you go to spectator.co.uk/fizz24. This offer is UK only and subject to availability.
Hello and welcome to part one of a very special Christmas edition of Spectator Out Loud. Each week we choose some of our favourite pieces from the magazine and ask their writers to read them aloud. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and on this week's podcast, after an extraordinarily eventful year, Katie Balls declares that 2025 could redefine politics. The theme of irritability runs through Craig Brown's Sassarist's Notebook. Revealing the inspiration behind becoming an author, Kate Weinberg explains the healing power of a father's bedtime reading. Reviewing a new four-volume edition of the collected prose of T.S. Eliot, Craig Rain explains why 4,000 pages of literary criticism is fatally purist. Lisa Hazeldine provides her notes on hymnals, demonstrating the Christmas legacy owed to Martin Luther. And finally, and featuring a special guest, Melissa Kite explains why she shouldn't be allowed to go to church. Up first, Katie Balls.
Santa will have a tricky time this year fulfilling all the Christmas wish lists in Westminster. Keir Starmer is desperately hoping for a change in the political weather, and Kemi Badenoch would like an in with Donald Trump. Ed Davey dreams that Labour's electoral troubles will get so bad that proportional representation starts to look appealing. Nigel Farage, meanwhile, wants to avoid what usually happens with him and keep his party from falling out. Come the new year, all four leaders will have their eyes on May's local elections. The 21 county councils, 10 unitary authorities, and one metropolitan district are up for grabs for the first time since 2021. Back then, Boris Johnson was riding a wave of popularity after the vaccine rollout and the Tories won Hartlepool from Labour. It is only months since Starmer won back the Red Wall and secured a large majority, but his government doesn't seem to be on sound footing. It feels rather shaky, admits a senior Whitehall figure. The Prime Minister is fast discovering that it's a lot easier to work out what people want, more money in their pockets, reduced NHS waiting lists and controlled immigration, than to deliver it. Starmer's task has become harder since his reset speech setting out his six milestones. Too many people in Whitehall are comfortable in the tepid bath of managed decline, he said. But these are the people he must rely on to get things done, and his words have led to a backlash from trade unions and civil servants. The appointment of Chris Wormald, known as Wormy by colleagues, to be Cabinet Secretary is a sort of conventional choice that led many to ask whether the government actually knows what it wants to achieve. Starmer needs some other people to pull his sleigh. It won't be his officials, says one put-out Mandarin. Some in his party think that the PM is now in a worse position than before he gave the speech. As one Labour MP puts it, he has admitted that there is a problem, but doesn't know how to fix it. There is a distinct possibility that the media will increasingly focus as much on the aims and ambitions of other big beasts in Starmer's cabinet, Wes Streeting and Angela Rayner, as on his own. The best he can hope for is that somehow, magically, there will be the growth that allows the funding of his government's plans, and that Reform and the Tories will face turbulence of their own. The Liberal Democrats will be pushing for closer economic and security ties with Europe to help protect the UK from the potential impacts of a Trump presidency. The Tories and Reform will push for a US trade deal. Labour, for all the claims that there can be no trade-offs, will have to decide which way to go as Farage cozies up to the new president. Conservative MPs, of course, have their own hopes and dreams. We want more Labour relaunches, says a member of the Shadow Cabinet. We want more of Keir Starmer's wooden performances and technocratic demeanour. A member of the Tory leader's inner circle says, I've been genuinely surprised by how bad they are. So far, those around Badenoch have been buoyed by the Prime Minister's travails. Starmer's poor start was compared with Tony Blair's at a recent Shadow Cabinet where the former Tory minister, Francis Maude, appeared as a guest speaker. He gave a pep talk on how to do opposition, offering a list of do's and don'ts. He said we need to accept that it's going to take time, that small wins are important, recalls one attendee. This series of presentations, Ian Duncan-Smith spoke last month, has had a galvanising effect on the opposition. The most obvious element that threatens to disrupt Badenoch's plan is Farage. What we don't want is more Nigel Farage dominating the headlines, admits the shadow minister. With Reform overtaking Labour in one poll, Badenoch will need strong local election results in May to demonstrate that the Tories are still the main opposition. Her team are looking to compare the party's showing with the general election result as opposed to 2021, which is the last time many of the councils were contested. It's not only Reform that she needs to worry about. Following a surprisingly good election result for the Lib Dems, Ed Davey, who was crowned Disruptor of the Year at the Spectator's Parliamentarian of the Year Awards, hopes to take more votes from the Tories in the Blue Wall and West Country. Some 26 of the 32 councils up for grabs are Conservative-controlled areas, including in Devon and Surrey, where the Lib Dems have made significant gains locally since 2021. The Lib Dems plan to attack Labour with greater ferocity in the new year, taking aim at the issue of social care when Streeting brings forward plans to fix the NHS. Similarly, Farage will from next month be throwing his whole life into making sure we had the biggest breakthrough in May on a tour of key target areas. With Zia Yusuf, the Reform Party chairman, looking to build up branches and the party boasting more than 100,000 members, this is being seen as a moment to show that Farage could have a push to number 10. We believe the Tories will hemorrhage seats in May, says a Reform figure. We make inroads, then we beat them in Wales. The narrative writes itself. We will be the ones for electoral credibility. Reform staff say they have had journalists trying to get hold of branded caps for workplace secret Santas. They think this is an indication that Reform is in vogue. If Farage has some success in May, figures on the Tory right could start to campaign for an electoral pact between the two parties. It's how we crush Starmer, says a Conservative Party figure. It's extraordinary that so much could be up for grabs so early in Starmer's premiership. But as the return of Trump and the collapse of social democratic governments in Europe show, the sands are shifting faster than ever, and 2025 could well be a year that redefines politics.
That was Katie Balls. Now, Craig Brown.
The most irritating word of the year was unwind. Unwind with one of our artisan cocktails in the curated ambiance of, and so on. For most of us, the call to unwind promotes the very stress it purports to alleviate. Radio 3 is currently the station most fretful about unwinding, beseeching us to ease into your day with welcoming harmonies and focus for the morning with stress-busting music. Its new 24/7 stream is called Classical Unwind. Is this a wind-up? If you're still feeling anxious by the evening, Classic FM offers Calm Classics at 10 p.m, the perfect soothing soundtrack to help you wind down at the end of the day. Oddly enough, the contemporary composer most often picked to help us unwind is Philip Glass, whose repetitive work sounds like a migraine set to music. For the past 11 years, two rock star neighbours in Holland Park have been finding it desperately hard to unwind. Things kicked off back in 2013 when Jimmy Page, then aged 69, first complained of plans for a 3,600-square-foot basement complex submitted to the council by his new neighbour, Robbie Williams, then aged 38. Their neighbourly dispute has rattled on ever since. In 2019, Williams was finally granted permission to start digging, but Page then won a counter-ruling that meant Williams's builders could only employ handheld tools. And so it went on. In 2016, Williams accused Page of spying on him. "It's like a mental illness," he said, a claim he was later obliged to withdraw. In May 2022, Williams was refused permission to cut back an 80-foot robinier tree. The following year, a two-story fence around his property was also turned down. Time marches on. Jimmy Page is now 80 years old, and Williams is 50 years old. 8 years older than Robert Jenrick, by the way. But neither shows any inclination to let bygones be bygones. Last month, Williams asked permission to cut down another tree, and a neighbour, unnamed but possibly you know who, is resisting it. Irritation breeds irritation. Online readers of the Times have rushed to support one side or the other. A tree that is too big or is in the wrong place is just a big weed, writes Nicholas Leach. Vandal, concludes Elizabeth Swift. Leave our trees alone, you spoilt brat, writes Anthony Crawford. His property, his decision, opines Thomas Dolan. Who cares? Asks Brian McNaught. Well, you do, apparently, enough to make a comment, replies J.D. Rowe. The days when rock musicians were the fount of peace, love and understanding are, it seems, long over. With the benefit of hindsight, should the angry young men of the 1950s be rebranded? Irritable young men might be closer to the mark. This year marked the 70th anniversary of the publication of Kingsley Amis's Lucky Jim, a novel that raised irritability to an art form. Amis's first wife, Hilly, noticed his appetite for irritation when they first met in 1946, when Kingsley was just 24. Indeed, she was irritated by his irritability, which might well have been his aim. She recalled him issuing what she said were endless complaints about what seemed to me harmless things, like apparently ordinary nice people going through the swing door at Elliston's restaurant. He'd start muttering, "Look at those fools, look at that idiot of a man," and so on. If doors got stuck or he was held up by some elderly person getting off a bus or the wind blew his hair all over the place, he would snarl and grimace in the most irritating fashion. Lucky Jim's anti-hero, Jim Dixon, bristles with irritation. At a dance, quotes, he was hot. His socks seemed to have been sprayed with fine adhesive sand, and his arms ached like those of a boxer keeping his guard up after 14 rounds. Amis's subsequent novels expand on his one great theme. It was no wonder that people were so horrible, observes the protagonist of One Fat Englishman, when they started life as children. It's what we do best. Our late queen was adept at concealing irritation, though not immune from feeling it. On YouTube, you can watch her growing testy with the Queen Mother. They are at Epsom in 1991. The Queen's horse, Enharmonic, the 5-1 favourite, finishes fourth. The Queen is clearly disappointed and wipes her eyes. The wind, she explains, is to blame for her tears. Her mother, standing just behind her, offers one of her pitying smiles and chuckles irritatingly. It's the emotion, perhaps. No, mummy, protests the Queen, her voice rising in exasperation. It's if you look into a wind like that. The Queen Mother says, yes, but in an if-you-insist tone, and then bumbles away, having enjoyed the last word. The Queen could also be irritated by unsavoury guests, and who could blame her? She told a friend of mine that she thought Donald Trump very rude. I put this in my new book, A Voyage Around the Queen. To my surprise, it became headline news. An irritated Trump was asked about it on camera. Never one to beat around the bush, the US president-elect called me a sleazebag and a phony. In this season of peace and goodwill, I'll offer him the last word and leave others to judge which of us is telling the truth. I heard I was her favourite president. She said it to a lot of people. She said it to friends of mine. President Trump was my favourite president.
That was Craig Brown. And next, Kate Weinberg.
It's half an hour before lights out when my dad arrives at my bedroom door holding Roald Dahl's Danny, the Champion of the World. He kicks off his shoes, loosens his tie and wedges himself next to me in my small single bed, his toes waggling in their socks as they regain freedom after a long day in the office. In the evening, he smells of the menthol toothpicks he always carries in his top pocket. In the morning, when he drops me off at school, he smells of the spicy pink toothpaste which I once tried and which burnt the roof of my mouth. I lie with my head resting in the crook of his arm as he flicks the book open to the first page, clears his throat, making his Adam's apple bob, and starts reading. When I was 4 months old, my mother died suddenly, and my father was left to look after me all by himself. When people ask me why I became an author, I always scroll back to this scene. I could tell them it was because my mother had also died suddenly when I was 3.5, leaving my older sisters and me unmoored in a frightening new world in which stories became my escape. That would be true too. But my mind always tugs me back to these moments with my father at the end of the day, squashed up in a bed as he drew pictures in the air with his deep reading voice. The green walls of my bedroom would fade away and we became other people in faraway worlds. Danny and his father picking their way through the forest as they went to outwit the greedy Victor Hazel by drugging and poaching all of his pheasants. Or the impoverished Sylvia and her rich cousin Bonnie from the Wolves of Willoughby Chase speeding through the frozen countryside in a train as the wolves howl around us. I see now that these nightly rituals did much more for me than instilled my love of reading and storytelling. My father was a South African businessman who had lost his young wife abruptly to a brain tumour, leaving him with three little girls and not much idea of what to do. Like the father in Danny, the Champion of the World, my dad was an eye smiler with twinkling eyes. We never doubted he loved us. But he wasn't given to expressing his emotions, much less talking to us about grief and loss, his or ours. Making sure he raced home from the office every day to read to us individually was his way of parenting us during a time I now understand is every father's worst nightmare. Being a man of few words, he borrowed them from others, and it was a kind of magic trick. Because looking back, I realised that it wasn't only that these were the times I felt most connected to my father, most loved and secured. I gained other parents too. All of the books that swept me away were about children who had lost one or both parents. There was Mary in The Secret Garden and Sarah Crewe in A Little Princess, and later Jane Eyre and Great Expectations, whose long words I would mispronounce when repeating proudly in class. Often they found strength in friendships or other parent figures, a strength gained through their adventures that let them stand on their own two feet and look after themselves. The writers never spelt it out. They were far too good for that, but the absent parent was always hovering between the lines. The redemption at the end of the story was never explicitly about dealing with loss, and yet it was always about that too. When the story ended, I felt a little stronger and wiser, inspired to be like one of those characters whose lives I had inhabited. For as long as I can remember, I wanted to be someone who made up stories like this too. Books that could look after people, stories that could have the effect of a good parent. But along with my dreams of being an author, there was always a parallel, more childish fantasy. One day, I would write a book for my father. I would dedicate it to him. Over the years, during a string of false starts and dead ends in becoming a fiction writer, I never stopped secretly toying with the words to this imaginary dedication. What could I possibly say to thank the father who had become my whole world, who had saved us when the world went dark after our mother died? Like my father before me, I was lost for words. These days, my dad is 93 and spends a fair amount of the day in bed. We've just started rereading Danny the Champion of the World together, an illustrated version with Quentin Blake drawings that he delights in. Now I am the one reading it to him. This magical, uplifting story about a father and motherless son whose bond becomes even closer when they embark on their daring heist. Being as old and powerless as my father now is must be its own version of a terrifying loss. And I hope the story, not just the act of reading to him, is in some way parenting him back. And I'm glad that I finally found the words to dedicate my first novel to him, which sits above us on the shelf as we turn the pages together. For Dad, who read to us night after night.
That was Kate Weinberg, and now Craig Rain.
This is Alice B. Toklas, ventriloquized by her partner Gertrude Stein. I must say that only three times in my life have I met a genius, and each time a bell within me rang and I was not mistaken. And I may say in each case, it was before there was any general recognition of the quality of genius in them. The three geniuses of whom I speak are Gertrude Stein, Pablo Picasso, and Alfred Whitehead, the mathematician. Defiantly, flagrantly clairvoyant. Daring us to dispute the claim, the big lie flourishes. Size matters. Think George Steiner, Joseph Brodsky, big whoppers both, tirelessly fibbing. Towards the end of his life in 1963, Eliot expressed his reservations about three early essays on which his reputation was founded: Shakespeare and the Stoicism of Seneca, Hamlet and his Problems, which introduced the objective correlative, and Four Elizabethan Dramatists. Eliot ruefully noted their callowness, their facility of unqualified assertion, which verges here and there on impudence. His criticism, as these four volumes of almost 4,000 pages demonstrate, is strewn with the unprovable. His criticism, as these four volumes of almost 4,000 pages demonstrate, is strewn with unprovable magisterial solipsism. For example, when Henry VII came to the throne, the English mind and the civilization that expressed it was cruder by a century than the French mind, and still further behind the Italian. How can he know? Again. But for Dryden's verse, we might not have the perfection of Congreve's prose, though this is not demonstrable. Again. At certain moments, a word can be made to insinuate the whole history of a language and a civilization. Is that all? We are frequently told by Eliot how much depends on poetry. We need constantly new poets, men who combine an exceptional sensibility with an exceptional power over words. Otherwise, our own ability, the ability of a whole people, not merely to express, but even to feel civilized emotions, will degenerate. This is a drum Eliot insistently beats, that the, quote, first duty qua poet is to the language of his country. First, he has the duty to preserve that language. His use of it must not weaken, coarsen or degrade it. Second, he has the duty to develop that language. This quasi-national service, I submit, is the last thing on a poet's mind when he starts to compose a poem in the immediate press of its imperious local demands and decisions. Moreover, so few people read poetry that it is hard to exaggerate its cultural unimportance. A great art, certainly, but a manifestly minority interest. If anything, having displaced poetry as notional cultural arbiter, pop songs are overwhelmingly influential. Weakening and coarsening, the Miley Cyrus effect, the wrecking ball of simplified sexuality. No wonder we prize the Beatles, She's Leaving Home, Eleanor Rigby. Take Eliot's auditory imagination, an impossible superpower invented in 1933, quote, the feeling for syllable and rhythm, penetrating far below the conscious levels of thought and feeling, invigorating every word, sinking to the most primitive and forgotten, returning to the origin and bringing something back, seeking the beginning and the end. It works through meaning, certainly, or not without meanings in the ordinary sense, and fuses the old and obliterated and the trite, the current and the new and surprising, the most ancient and the most civilized mentality. Far below the conscious levels of thought and feeling. Unprovable, in other words. But a potent, seductive assertion, a poetic truth, and one which feeds Seamus Heaney's poem, Bone Dreams. I push back through dictions, Elizabethan canopies, Norman devices, the erotic Mayflowers of Provence, and the ivied Latins of Churchmen, to the scope's twang, the iron flash of consonants cleaving the line. In the coffered riches of grammar and declensions, I found Bahnhus, the skeleton in the word hoard. Eliot's explanatory gloss is so vague and all-encompassing, it has come to mean that the sound is also the carrier of sense, an area of fraught subjectivity. Eliot in 1951. Quote, it is a common experience that a poem found difficult when read to oneself is suddenly elucidated when read aloud by someone who has understood it. Close quote. Soon enough, Helen Gardner recommended reading the poems aloud as a way of unlocking their meaning. It doesn't work. How did Eliot impose his views so effectively, so hypnotically? It is partly the disarming self-deprecation, the highly intelligent ignoramus, in tandem with the critical aggrandizement, a little anthology. I have no capacity for abstract thought. The Notes to the Wasteland are dismissed as a display of bogus scholarship. I wish I had taken Hegel more seriously in my youth, but like many people, I was caught napping. Eliot's injunctions to thoroughness contribute to his authority. To understand Dryden's view of Shakespeare, we must read all of his critical writing. Compare Eliot's essay on John Ford. We must know all of Shakespeare's work in order to know any of it. The implication is that Eliot has done the work, the homework, all of it. Then there is his obsessive compulsive resort to definition, the parade of precision. Take a single representative essay, Shakespeare Criticism, 1934. It begins with a complaint that the categories of comedies, histories, and tragedies are undefined. Quote, "We have first to grasp what criticism is, and second, to grasp the relation between literary and philosophical criticism on the one hand, and literary and textual criticism on the other." This is a typical pre-ramble. But having complained, then defined everything in sight, Eliot springs on his read of the hypothesis that comedy and tragedy are subliminally identical. Quote, "For those who have experienced the full horror of life, tragedy is still inadequate. In the end, horror and laughter may be one. Only when horror and laughter have become as horrible and laughable as they can be, then only do you perceive that the aim of the comic and tragic dramatist is the same." From this volte-face, Eliot proceeds to the ineffable Shakespeare. Quote, "In the greatest poetry, there is always a hint of something behind, something impersonal, something in relation to which the author has been no more than a passive, if not always pure, medium. Literary spiritualism." So, winning self-irony, a display of rigorous definition, followed by an incoherently impressive but passionate semi-confessional disclosure. Mystery. Mystification. In 1932, writing about Dryden, Eliot says, quote, "We often feel, with Shakespeare and now and then with his lesser contemporaries, that the dramatic action on stage is the symbol and shadow of some serious action in a world of feeling more real than ours." Close quote. It is a central plank, unsurprisingly, of Eliot's programme that the poet is not the final authority on the meaning of his poems. The meaning lies somewhere between the poet and the reader. Further, the poem should contain material outside the poet's conscious control. No surprise, then, that Eliot in his essay on Vers Libre should invoke, quote, "the inexplicable line with the music which can never be captured in other words."
That was Craig Raine. And next, Lisa Hazeldine.
It's 500 years since Martin Luther, along with the preacher Paul Spiratus, put together the first Protestant hymn book, the Achtliederbuch, literally the book with eight songs. Collections of liturgical chants and songs had existed before, but they had never been meant for the congregation, just for choirs. Luther believed collective sung worship in German, as opposed to Latin, was key to spreading the Reformation's ideas and inspiring converts. What better way to engage worshippers than to include them in the church services they were attending? A catchy, simple melody and words everyone could understand, regardless of status or ability to read, helped too. The Achtliederbuch was very popular in Europe, prompting Luther's critics to worry, not without cause, that, to quote, "people are singing themselves into his doctrines." Luther followed up the Achtliederbuch with an expanded hymnal later the same year. The Erfurt Enchiridion was printed in two competing editions, one containing 25 hymns, the other 26, 18 authored by Luther. With these hymns, the book's preface declared the days of church clergy, quote, "roaring like wild donkeys to a deaf god," would be over. Hymnology blossomed with Lutheranism. It's apt that Bach was born in Eisenach, the small Thuringian town where Luther went to school, because he was particularly inspired by Luther's hymns. He incorporated many of them into his own chorales and cantatas, such as Christ lag in Todesbanden, transforming Luther's staid tunes into florid, elaborate melodies for voice and orchestra. The spread of the Reformation also brought Luther's hymnals to England, and the Enchiridion was partially translated into English in 1555. While many of the Church of England's most loved hymns owe their existence to the Victorians and Edwardians, some German hymns have slipped through, albeit heavily disguised. Catherine Winkworth's 1863 translation of the 1680s hymn Lobet den Herrn, for example, survives as the regal Praise to the Lord the Almighty, retrofitted in 1953 with a shimmering soprano descant in the final verse. If there's one place in the Anglican musical tradition where Luther's legacy is thriving, it's in our love of carols. The twinkly In Dulce Jubilo first appeared in print in a Lutheran hymnal in 1533. Luther himself is rumoured to be the librettist of one of the verses. Perhaps the most majestic piece to owe its existence to Luther's enterprise is Ivor Atkinson's arrangement of Peter Cornelius's Three Kings. In it, the choir sings a translation of Philip Nicolai's 1599 chorale, Wie schön leuchtet der Morgenstern, with Cornelius's own melody woven over the top. The result is sublime. At once mystical and warm, it brings the adoration of the Magi to life and transports the listener to the cribside of Jesus. Without Luther's promotion of the hymnal, there is every chance that this chorale and many of the oldest Protestant hymns would have long ago been lost to history. 500 years on, even those who set foot in a church just once a year in December are spreading the word of God through song, thanks to Luther and his hymnals.
That was Lisa Hazeldine, and finally, Melissa Kite.
Life is changed, not ended, said the slogan on the lectern, as the priest told his flock what to think about a difficult subject with a reassuring smile. It's quite a big change, I whispered to the builder boyfriend, who was staring down at his feet in an attempt to stop the allergic response that was welling up. The service was commemorating those who have died this past year in our corner of West Cork. But the overall optimistic way it was being done was making us feel ever so slightly hysterical. I stared at the slogan on the lectern, an excerpt from the Roman Missal, embroidered on an ornamental cloth. Someone would have had to commission those words to be stitched on that cloth. I hadn't seen it before. It was hardly festive. I stared at the priest, who's a towering man with a big mop of white hair. Of course it doesn't help in moments like this that he looks like Father Ted. Mrs. Doyle, could you ask Sister Mary Gondola to stitch us a lectern cover with a nice, cheerful death theme?
Yes, Father. I know exactly what you mean. That lovely bit about death being a nice change of scene.
That's it exactly. More about the crack in heaven and the actual, you know, dying bit. Maybe mention the free alcohol and the roller skating. I'd looked around the church at the icons, paintings and frescoes, noting the Masonic golden triangle with an eye inside it, topping a vast image of Christ on the wall behind the altar. I stared at the statue to the left of the altar and leaned into the BB. Have you noticed how Mary has got a halo made of the 12 EU stars? That wasn't very fair of me. He had to plunge his face into a handkerchief and cough. Really, we shouldn't go to church. We only notice what we're sceptical about, but we go because we believe and we want to check in somewhere. So we check in with the denomination of our upbringing and then we sit stewing over what the Catholic establishment is doing to our faith. Our Lady of the EU stars and a big all-seeing Masonic eye staring down on us, reminding us to be good citizens and do as we're told, which, according to this priest, includes not going on social media to read the latest conspiracy theories, which is exactly what we do, because we've come to the view in the past few years that conspiracy theory is what they used to call news. The list of the dead was long, and as the priest read out the names, most of which we recognise because since coming to live in this small community, we've got to know almost everyone, I started to feel unusual. We've come to live here by mistake, is a joke the builder bee and I often cry at as we're driving around these remote hillsides, invoking our favourite line in With Nell and I, when Richard E. Grant's character begs a local in the Lake District for help finding fuel and food. We ran away to Cork, the rebel county, and we got here to find a landscape as beautiful as we had hoped, but a society even more determined to keep a lid on rebellion than the one we left behind. I would have felt better about it if the priest had not started trying to explain the amount of death happening around us by comparing people to trees dying off in winter. He said it was normal and natural. I nudged the BB and he shook his head. 20-odd names read out in a church may not sound a lot, but there's only a few hundred people living here. It doesn't feel natural, and I'm very sorry to be the death party pooper by saying that. The priest told us there was nothing to fear, and quoted two of the most terrifying lines in Revelation, which he called the Book of Apocalypse. What on earth, I thought, is he trying to prepare us for? This priest told us when he arrived here last year that he just had two stents put in his heart. But if he's feeling fatalistic, that doesn't mean we have to. Never mind the afterlife. I won't be told that death is so insignificant it's not worthy of critical thought. Our poor neighbour next door, a farmer in his 50s, strong as an ox, nearly 7 feet tall with hands like shovels, was struck down with a brain tumour last year. A few weeks ago, his wife was told by the doctors to make her bed up downstairs, and the ambulance dropped him home because there was nothing more they could do. Faith-wise, I can be happy that death is not the end, but I take issue with the notion that people are like trees. My neighbour is not a sycamore. He's not growing back next spring. Life has changed, not ended. Yes, that's a good one. But here's an even better one from John 10:10, very apposite for this time of year. I came that they may have life and have it in abundance.
And that's everything for this week. Join us again next week for part two of our Christmas special. If you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd really appreciate a review and a follow, however you subscribe. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and I hope you join us again next week.